The Rambam, Maimonides. What does the Rambam stand for? Rabbi Moshe ben Maimon, referred to as the Rambam, as opposed to the Ramban. It's not only a difference of the last letter, also a difference of emphasis. The Rambam and the Ramban, two different people. Oftentimes they go head to head on a literature level. They did overlap for a few years, but not by much, not by enough to actually talk to each other. But the Rambam was born in 1135. What's interesting about the Rambam's life specifically, or at least where he comes from specifically, is he also represents a sort of a transition. You know, the Rambam's father, Maimon, right, or Moshe ben Maimon, so Maimon was actually a student of someone named the Rimigash. The Rimigash, Rabbi Yosef ben Meir ibn Migash. Migash was a place. His father's name was Meir. Somehow his acronym became the Rimigash. But the Rimigash's Rebbe, the Rimigash's teacher, was the Rif. So, and the Rif was basically the end of the Gaonic period. Some people will call him the beginning of the Rosh Hashanah, but basically what you have within the Rambam is the culmination of the Gaonim moving into the Rishonim. Now, obviously, Rashi in 1040 was already the beginning of the Rishonim period in Ashkenazic Jewry, but in terms of Sephardic Jewry, or what we call now Spain, you know, so the Rambam is perhaps the greatest and most formidable Rishon from the Spanish era. Here, right? So there are people beforehand, obviously, like you know, like the Rimigash and other lesser known Rishonim that people aren't familiar with. But when you hear names like the Ramban and the Rashba and the Rivash and the Ritva, right? All of those people come after the Rambam. They're all in Spain, and they all come after the Rambam. Interestingly enough, culturally, the Rambam is at the end of what's called historically the Golden Age of Spain. But he's really at the beginning of the golden age of Jewish Spain, right? Because although he was against poetry, many of the people that came after him, you know, and studied not only Torah, obviously, but also sort of the ways of poetry, as you can find in many of their introductions to the Torah, speaking of introductions to the Chumash commentary, people like the Ibn Ezra and the Ramban, you'll find that they actually use the mode of poetry in their own writings. It is interesting that there is a Rabbeinu Chananel also uses poetry, and he wasn't necessarily really... he wasn't really a Sephardic. It wasn't from Spain, but he was in a Sephardic land. But he wasn't necessarily part of the thinking of the Rambam. But he also used poetry. Either way, the Rambam is born in 1135. Some people say 1138. It's kind of interesting thing that we don't know when the Rambam was born. The Rambam, perhaps the greatest of all, you know, illuminaries that we have, we don't actually know when he was born. You know, from all of the documentation that we have,
he wasn't great at the time.
What? By what calendar are you referring to?
The Julian
Gregorian?
No, that was later.
I'm not familiar.
I think that was 15th century.
Yeah, 1400s.
Yeah.
Not my area of expertise, which I can say about everything, thankfully. but 1135. So that's the Rambam, 1135. And he's born in Cordova, Spain. Now, that obviously means he's born to a Sephardic family. And despite the fact that he's, throughout his life, always going to be in a Sephardic area, as we'll see, he has an immense influence, not only on Sephardic Jews, but on everybody, for Jewry of all time, which we'll get to eventually. So his father, Rabbi Maimon, here's an interesting Chanoch Lenar Al Pi Darko tidbit, speaking of some of our usual Mishle attendees. So Rabbi Maimon, his father, actually had two wives. The Rambam actually was born from his first wife, who shortly thereafter passed away. Not sure if it was actually in childbirth or it was later. But what's interesting is that Rabbi Maimon, his father, actually seems to have had a much greater attention to the second wife's children than to the Rambam himself. And there are some interesting legends about the Rambam acting out and not behaving and not learning and not studying. You know, like your classic legendary tale. They say that also about the Baal Shem Tov was a big troublemaker. They could never find him in school. He was always running away and doing something in the woods. The Netziv has a story in his introduction to Emek Shela, which talks about how he wasn't a good student, right? He wasn't mischievous. He just wasn't an academic. And then he obviously became the Netziv. Fascinating story. Hopefully we can talk about him at some point too. But the Rambam... at some point, he does learn from his father. A lot of the Torah that he learns is from his father. and apparently when the Rambam was 6 years old, he actually got a bracha from the Rinnegash. And in the Rambam's introduction to Mishnayos, he actually talks about how he got a bracha from the Rinnegash, and it was a part of his success that he was able to meet the Rinnegash, and speaks very highly of the Rinnegash, which is just an interesting connection to a previous generation that we have from the Rambam. When he's about bar mitzvah age, now this is hard to gauge because we said it was either that he was born in 1135 or 1138. When he was about bar mitzvah age, so a different ruling power takes over in Cordova, and those are named the Almohads, also known as the Berber dynasty. They conquered Cordova, and the reason that was important is because when the Almohads come in, they actually get rid of a very important status quo, structure in the community, which was called the Dhimmi status. The Dhimmi status was basically that there's a hierarchy of worth. You have the Sephardi, you have the Muslims, and then you have the people that work, that are underneath the Muslims. And as long as everybody else, meaning the Christians and the Jews, are willing to accept the fact that they're on a lower level, meaning they're called the Dhimmi, as long as they're okay with that, and they have to keep caveats with conditions, as long as they're okay with that, we won't bother them. Now the Almohads come in when the Rambam's about 13 years old and say, no more Dhimmi status, we're just going to get rid of you. So how are we going to get rid of you? We're going to give you three choices. And this is pretty classic, unfortunately, in Jewish history. One choice is convert. But you have to be really Islamic. You can't just pretend to be Islamic. And there are some historians, by the way, who think the Rambam pretend converted, that he was actually posing as a Muslim for a while. There's a bit, like the next 10 years in the Rambam's life are a little hazy in terms of where he was from the years 13 to 23. So basically, one option is convert, one option is to get out of here, and the third option is obviously, we'll just kill you. Yeah, three easy options, take your pick. Now the most complicated one, as I said, some historians believe the Rambam did, was to convert. The reason that was complicated is because anyone who converted was always suspected of not really being a convert. And what they had to dress up, they had to put on a star, as we're familiar with, unfortunately, and they were basically under public scrutiny everywhere they went, to make sure they were acting like a Muslim. Right? It was very difficult. And oftentimes it didn't matter if, they actually acted like a Muslim or not. They would just persecute them and they would leave either way. The Rambam and his family, according to, I guess, mainstream thinking, say that they actually left. Where did they go? So they probably jumped around a few different cities in Spain for a while. Legend has it that the Rambam actually started writing his Perusha Mishnayos at this time. When he was a teenager still. But the truth is that it was probably a little later. Then they settle in a place called Fez. Anyone know where Fez is?
Morocco.
I want
to go there.
You want to go there?
I want to go see where he lives.
So he has a house there that they still have marked off. You've seen pictures.
Well, it's the only Muslim country in the world that allows the Jewish Muslim.
Really? Interesting. I didn't know that. That is a fun fact. Yeah. And not so fun fact, I guess.
Well, but it's still a Muslim country.
Right.
So for me to
yeah.
go there,
wow.
I have to join a tour. You can't travel.
Oh, you can't just go alone? That's probably not a good idea.
Yeah. But I do want to go to Fez.
Yeah, no, so they have, it's like this little alleyway, and it's got like a, a very unassuming door, and they say it's the Rambam's house. I don't know, I haven't looked into it enough to know what the confirming details are to say that it's the Rambam's house, but they had a house in Fez, Morocco, and he's living there basically when he's 23 years old. He apparently wrote his Perusha Mishnayos at this time. He also wrote some of his essays, like the eight chapters, people are familiar with, the Shemona Prekim, which is his introduction, I think, to, what is it, Perek HaChelek? I oftentimes get them confused. It's Perek HaYavos. And then the Yud Gimel Karim is before Perek HaChelek. Yeah. So he writes basically two formidable essays already at this age in terms of his Jewish thought. One is the Shemona Prekim, which goes through a lot of philosophy of character and how to be a good person. And then the Yud Gimel Karim, which goes through how to be a believing Jew. It should be noted, and we talked about Rabbeinu Yonah last month, so maybe you're already familiar with this, that there is much opposition in the long term to the Rambam's ideas, not only specifically the ideas that he said, but the fact that he focused on philosophy. Right, he focused on beliefs as opposed to actions. Judaism is a predominantly religion of actions. We are not going to judge you for how you believe. We're not going to judge you for what's inside your brain. We're going to judge you based on what you do. And that's, you know, that's really the only way that we can actually assess a situation is what happens in real life. But nonetheless, modern thinkers and, you know, history basically proves the Rambam right in the way that we all basically follow the Rambam's ideal of, you know, the Yugim Likarim and thinking of the 13 principles of faith. I'm sure there are a bunch of, you know, people that believe otherwise or believe not necessarily in the sort of the do or die aspect of the Rambam. There, you could believe other people, and you only have to look a couple pages into the Mishnah Torah to realize that people don't aren't in full unanimous decision about the Rambam's beliefs. But either way, when he's about 32 years old, the Rambam goes with his sons. He had two sons. One we don't really know much about. The other one's name was Avraham. Avraham ben Harambam. He basically spends his whole life defending his father, which is just an interesting thing to live your life doing. He visits Eretz Yisrael. And in a specific letter, it sounds like, and this has major halachic implications, it sounds like the Rambam went up to Har Habayis. That's what it sounds like. Yeah, apparently it's not so clear, and I don't know Arabic, so I couldn't tell you exactly what it says. But that's what apparently it says, that he went on to Har Habayis in this visit to Eretz Yisrael. Not only is that halachically problematic or halachically complicated, let's say, especially given the Rambam stance of the Kedusha of Eretz Yisrael versus the Kedusha of Yerushalayim and Har Habayis specifically, but it gets even more complicated because then the Rambam leaves Eretz Yisrael. I was just talking to Yosef about this, that the Rambam also thinks one is not allowed to leave Eretz Yisrael. There's a legend that says that when he would sign his letters, he would actually point out the fact that he shouldn't have left Eretz Yisrael. But it's probably a legend. It's not necessarily true. Either way, he leaves Eretz Yisrael because of financial difficulties and ends up going to Fustat. Anyone know where Fustat is? Nowadays, it's known as Cairo. and he basically becomes the head of Cairo, the head rabbi of Cairo, also known as the Nagid, which was the chief rabbi position of that time. His son and grandson take over that position afterwards. He lives the rest of his life in Cairo. But something very important happens when they get to Cairo, shortly thereafter. So he had a brother, David. His brother, or as he would have said it, David. His brother David was basically the Zevulun to his Yisachar, right? He was the one that would go out and make the money, etc. He was a merchant. He would take all of his goods and he would go out and take the wares. He would go out to these trips and bring them back and sell his wares, etc. So at one point, the Rambam tells David to go to Sudan to buy some goods, and nowhere else. And David apparently not only goes to Sudan and realizes that he doesn't like the stuff there, he then also takes a trip to India. And on the way to India, there was a big storm at sea, and David passes away, dies at sea, along with the family's entire fortune. And now the family is stuck with no money, no resources. So what does the Rambam do? He's not able to learn anymore. So what did he do? He became a doctor, became a physician. No, the Rambam had already, it wasn't like the Rambam said, okay, now I got to go to medical school. It was more like he had already gone to medical school when he was in Fez. He'd already learned, you know, medicine and the profession already before. So it's not like, you know, he only did it once he had to. So there's a big, everyone likes to point hashkafa differences to the Rambam, whatever. But the Rambam was doing this already beforehand. When he didn't have to do it, he already learned the sciences, which is why when he's in Cairo, or Fustat, when he's at that place, he's already well-learned in medicine, and he can just become a physician. It's like overnight. It wasn't like he had to then go to medical school. And obviously, like the Rambam oftentimes expresses or shows us, he was very proficient at his medical practice, so much so that he becomes the physician of the Sultan Saladin, which gave him a lot of clout around the region. Unfortunately for him, that means he had a lot of people knocking on his door. And we have letters from the Rambam which talk about his daily schedule, which basically leaves no time for learning. And he basically says, I have no time to learn. I come back from the Saladin Palace, whatever, and I come to my home and there are people, you know, lines out the door waiting for me for my medical advice. And I helped him out. I don't remember if there was like a time limit or a curfew or something like that. Suffice it to say, he not only took care of all the Jews and non-Jews, but he also managed to write the Mishnah Torah. But
he also wrote some medical works.
Yes, he did write some works on sciences. He talks about things that we're dealing with today, you know, hepatitis and I think asthma and diabetes, like very common things. Now, you know, it's not that he was like, you know, he wasn't talking 2019 medicine in 1170, but he was very proficient, and a lot of his works are used.
His treatise on asthma was used well into the 1800s.
He said the asthma, his asthma information was used into the 1800s, you said?
Mm-hmm. Was the standard textbook on asthma.
So it's definitely an impressive thing for one of our greatest rabbis in history.
Did he also write the letter to his son?
That's Ramban.
Oh, that's the Ramban. Yeah, that's Nachmanides. Okay. Also living around this time in 1174. 1174? No, 1194.
He was a doctor.
Was the Ramban a doctor?
I think so.
He might have been. I don't know.
Go back to the beginning. I don't think you've covered enough of him here.
He was born in 1135. His father, mostly. His father mostly, even despite the legends that he was a misbehaving child, he learned from his father. He also, when he got to Fez, Morocco, he actually sat in the base madrash for a few years next to the shul. I don't know if you can see that on the tour of Fez also, but apparently there was a base madrash there and he learned there for many years. I don't know with who, under what guidance or anything, but he was already in his 20s. He could.
We should plan a trip.
Yes, let's go on a class trip to Fez.
It's also
There's a lot of places there.
Tiberio also.
Marrakesh and a Jewish presence.
Okay. Not familiar.
Supposed to be very.
A couple years ago in Kansas, I gave an alternate class like this, not called Legends and Lessons, but called Lands and Lessons. And we went alphabetically through different countries of the world to show like where there was a Jewish presence and what it looked like. Like very small places you would never think had Jewish presence. We would talk about that. Yeah, Yosef.
The Nitzav wrote, I think it was a joke, but the Nitzav apparently wrote that the Rambam made a lot of mistakes because he didn't have a charusa.
Oh, yeah?
I believe it's a joke because the Nitzav also went by himself.
Uh-huh. Interesting. I would like to see that quote if you could find it. But either way, so he assumes the Nagid position in Cairo, and he's also a physician in Cairo. by the way, I didn't mention this, but for all of the reputation of the Ramban being, you know, an intellectual, irrational, and a very, you know, dry thinker, he apparently was distraught for 2 years after his brother's death. Like he couldn't get over himself. He was sick in bed. He was like debilitated. He couldn't do anything. And we have letters which talk about his difficulties in those years. So it wasn't like he was emotionless. It was just that, you know, when you're a decisor of law, you have to be very exacting. Either way, we talked about how he was an expert not only in halacha but also in sciences. He writes the Mishneh Torah from 1170 to 1180. That's 10 years took him to write the book, which even if that was all he was doing would be impressive, but he wrote it while he was being a physician in the city. People are familiar with the Mishneh Torah. It's an enormous, not only enormous in how many pages and how many words, but enormous in terms of its contribution to sort of the form of the book. You know, before this, the only type of sefer that you could write, which was like a halachic decisive book, was based on the Gemara. So the Rif has perhaps one of the most famous examples of this, the Rush also, but the Rif basically takes the Gemara, distills it into its conclusions, and makes a book. So if the Gemara is 110 pages, the Rif will be about 35 pages. He'll just distill the Gemara, take out all the in-betweens, all the back and forth of the proofs and everything. He'll just give you the bottom of the line. All right, bottom line, this is how we rule, this is how we paskin. The Rambam said that we need a more comprehensive, thorough, and logically sequential. Yeah, user-friendly book. So he makes titles, he makes topics, he makes chapters and halachas where you can find everything. So that if you want to find a halacha, you don't just say, go to the page 32 in this edition of the Rif. Right? Instead, you can say, go to the Rambam, chapter 6, halacha 4, right? Whatever it is, right? So you can basically just tell people where to go. I did that today during Mechamarev. right? The Rambam, Hilchos Tefillah, Perek Zayin, you know, Halacha Yud Beis. That's why I quoted today in Mincha Maariv. So the Rambam himself was not only innovative in terms of his genius, but also in terms of his, in terms of the structure of his book. And we have, by the way, manuscripts from the Cairo Geniza, which is a whole other story, but, you know, very important for Jewish history, the Cairo Geniza. But we have manuscripts from the Rambam of the Mishnah Torah where he crosses out words and he rewrites words and he rewrites sentences. He was meticulous in how he says things. And because of that, because of his meticulousness in terms of how he wrote the Mishnah Torah, there are literally hundreds, if not thousands, of commentaries on the Mishnah Torah. Perhaps, if I were to guess, one of the, if not the, one of the most commentary-based books that we have. We have a Chumash, obviously, where everyone has a parashat Chumash. But beside for God's words, the Rambam's words are the most commented on. You know, if you look at anyone who's familiar with Bar Ilan, Bar Ilan, the college, so Bar Ilan has a responsa database, which basically allows you to look through different sources, etc. And on the side, it'll have, you know, Shulchan Aruch and its commentaries, and the Torah and its commentaries. There's an entire section just for the Rambam's commentaries. And you look at the list, it's got to be at least hundreds. Or just on the site. That's not even the stuff that they put on the website. But it's unbelievable the amount that the Rambam put into the work, and therefore the amount of work that the super commentaries put into the work also. And it's poured over every single day in yeshivas throughout the world. One of the problems with the Mishnah Torah that other people had is that he doesn't quote sources. And in fact, at the end of the Rambam's life, which was in 1204, he was actually working on another book to bring all the sources for everything he wrote. For whatever reason, we don't have it anymore. But he was actually, you know, he regretted it and was working on it. And then he died, unfortunately. He also wrote a book in 1190 called the Mor Nevuchim. We've talked about that before, which was perhaps, you know, not one of the records that you want to have, but probably one of, besides the Talmud, one of the most burned books in Jewish history, the Mor Nevuchim, because of its philosophical leanings and its secular influences and stuff like that. Rabbeinu Yonah, who we talked about last time, was part of that book burning, who then regretted it later on, if you remember, tried to go to the Rambam's kever to ask for forgiveness. Rabbeinu Yonah came after the Rambam, or at least the tail end. I don't remember when he died. Or when he was born. But either way, so this is one of the most, you know, controversial books at that time in Jewish history. Nowadays, it's sort of like, you know, mainstream Jewish thought. But there are still some things in there that people wouldn't be comfortable with. But it talks a lot about, well, the first third is actually kind of very dense and tedious about words and the linguistics and stuff like that. But the last two-thirds is actually very interesting, very thought-provoking, in some places very controversial. So that's the Mor Nevuchim, which at least in his introduction says is not for everybody. In fact, it's written specifically to one of his students. I think his name was Joseph. But it was, you know, as I think I said last time, you don't write hundreds of pages for one person. It's clearly meant for everybody else to read also. There is a bit of discussion, especially with the technicality of the book, whose translation is more accurate. And when it comes to philosophy, you really have to get translations that are very accurate and that are based on, you know, the common vernacular of Arabic lands at that time. But either way.
Now, the Mishnah Torah was written in Hebrew, though.
Yes, yes. The Rambam, and this is probably interesting, thank you for reminding me. The Rambam, when he writes the Mishnah Torah, which was before the Mor Nevuchim, so he makes a very startling claim. And he says that this is the only book that anyone has to read. Now that's obviously not an easy phrase to say, that you don't need the Gemara and you don't need the Torah. You just have to, I mean, maybe he would say to read the Torah. But basically the Mishnah Torah, and as we'll see in a second how this manifests itself, the Mishnah Torah is all you need to know about anything Jewish. And that was another one of the critiques of the book, which is that people won't learn anymore. And that was also one of the critiques of the Shulchan Aruch when that came out, that people aren't going to learn anymore. They're just going to open up a Shulchan Aruch. Halavai that people should only look up the Shulchan Aruch. But either way, so the Rambam basically makes this codification, and he makes it for the masses that they should all be able to learn it. So one of the reasons that it's written only in Hebrew is because of that feat. As opposed to the Perashat Mishnah, which is written in Arabic, and the Mor Nevuchim, which is written in Arabic, the Mishnah Torah is written in Hebrew, in very precise Hebrew. Not Hebrew that we use nowadays, but that's because of other reasons. But it's so that it's usable for all time for all Jews. Because if there's one language the Jewish people will always know, it's the language of Hebrew. So that's why he did that. So when you read the Mishneh Torah, that's the original. Those are the original words of the Rambam. There are some manuscripts that are always up for debate. What was the word here? What was the word there? But either way, the Rambam precisely put in that book things that were oftentimes extra halachic, meaning non-halachic, because he thought it was important for people to know those things also, which we'll see in a second when it comes to Hanukkah. Which translation? Yeah. So Kapak is the contemporary translator of the Rambam. He actually spoke to the Rambam and discussed with him certain translations. Now, I don't think he passed his translation over with the Rambam. Yeah, Ibn Tibbon. Isn't that the same thing? Kapak was later? I guess. Well, there's another one, which is Pines. I don't know if you know P-I-N-E-S, another famous translation. So yeah, I'm probably confusing Ibn Tibbon with whoever you're talking about. Ibn Tibbon was a contemporary translator of the Rambam's works, specifically the Morna Vilchim, which was making waves in the Jewish community, obviously, and that's why he felt he needed to translate it, and apparently had correspondence with the Rambam, which is why many people look at that as one of the more authentic translations. But I think he translated it into Hebrew, not into English. So that also comes with a whole slew of secondary mistranslations, whatever. Kapak, I'm not familiar with. I have a Friedlander at my home, and I know Pines is very popular nowadays. I don't know about Kapak.
Has a translation?
I don't know his first name, maybe. Either way, so the Rambam passes away. Happens to be that I mistakenly thought he passed away in Kislev because he passed away on December 12th, 1204. He actually passed away in Teves because of the way the calendar worked out. So next month we'll do something else, someone else in Teves. But he did pass away December 12th, which is next Thursday. But in the Jewish, more significant calendar, he passed away on the 20th of Teves. And Avram takes over not only as the chief rabbi of Cairo, but also as the doctor of the Sultan, which is just interesting. The son actually completely took over the Rambam's positions. Apparently, he was buried temporarily in Cairo. He ultimately was brought to, anyone know where he is? In Tiberia, where you can go. And we talked about that in Rabbeinu Yonah's class also, that he was trying to get there, but he couldn't do it. I have notes that the family, the Rambam's family, actually held the chief rabbi position until the end of the 1300s, which is a long time. We talked about the controversies about his different works, and we talked about how the fact that his works have basically become mainstream, not only halacha, but also Judaism. What happens basically with the Mishneh Torah? So Rabbi Yosef Kairo, when he was writing the Shulchan Aruch, so the Shulchan Aruch is basically the template for all modern-day halacha. The Ramah is obviously an Ashkenazic gloss over the Shulchan Aruch, but wherever the Ramah is not talking, so it's everybody's halacha. And so how did the Rabbi Yosef Kairo come up with the bottom line of the Shulchan Aruch, what we're supposed to do today? So he says he based it on three people. Number one was the Rif, number two was the Rambam, and number three was the Rush. But if you look actually at the Shulchan Aruch, any time that there's actually disagreement between those three, so the Shulchan Aruch says, I'm going to choose two out of three. That's, Achor Yabim Hatos, right? You always follow the majority. But practically, when it comes to how it shook out, they say that 75% of the Shulchan Aruch is just the Rambam. Either because he was one of the two-thirds, or because he was the only one that spoke about something. He's 75% of our modern-day halacha is the Rambam's psak. That's just a startling number on its own right. But then you factor in the fact that he was a predecessor to the Shulchan Aruch, not a predecessor to Sephardic work necessarily. I mean, the Shulchan Aruch has become Sephardic because of the Ramah, but the Shulchan Aruch was supposed to be a great unifier, and it is in many ways. So the Rambam is not only a posig for Sephardim, he's a posig for everybody. And he did so well, he was a doctor. It's just unbelievable person. That's why you know. That's why people make such a big deal about him. Not only because of his influence of Jewish thought, but also his influence in terms of halacha. If you look at these four pictures up here, so this first one is not necessarily what the Rambam looked like, but it is an artist's depiction. Not sure from when, but it's just important to realize that that's what people from the left. When people put this picture up, that's what people are referring to as the Rambam. The second one is his kever in Tveria. It's hard to tell, but this second picture you can see on the top of the grave, it says, Mi Moshe ad Moshe lo kam kamoshe. I don't know whose words those were. I think it might have been a rabbi's words. But what's interesting about it is that some people say, or some people wanted to claim, I had a rebbe that wanted to claim once, that meant that no one was ever named Moshe until the Rambam, which is definitely not true. Not only because it doesn't sound like it could be true, but also because we know people that you know. I could only think of one person. Does anyone know? Anyone know a Moshe that came between Moshe Rabbeinu and the Rambam?
Cordovero.
Who? Cordovero is Sfat later on.
He's later.
Yeah. No, any Moshe's? No. Also, that's the Ramah later on. Anyone know any Rambam? Any Moshe's? It's not an easy question. There was a Rebbe of mine at YU did not know any Moshe's in between. There's a one notable one that's quoted in Rashi many times in Chumash, named Rabbi Moshe Hadarshan. And if Rashi is quoting Rabbi Moshe Hadarshan, that means he came before the 11th century. So that's got to be between Moshe Rabbeinu and Moshe the Rambam.
They name people Yishmael.
Yeah. Names are an interesting study in Judaism, for sure. But that's what it says, Moshe Lakam Kamoshe. Referring to prowess, obviously, not necessarily to his name. I believe this is a statue in Cairo. I'm not sure what the last picture is. It's just an interesting. I think it might be, if I'm not mistaken, in like the House of Representatives or something, one of the U.S. Capitol buildings. They have like different, you know, important people on the wall going around. You know, there's like a rotunda. People know what I'm talking about. There's like a rotunda with a lot of people on it. I think that's what that picture is from. Okay, here's the Rambam in Hilchos Chanukah. Interestingly enough, Rambam groups in terms of his book Hilchos Chanukah with Hilchos Megillah. Why would he do that?
They're post temple.
Right, they're both post Beis Hamikdash holidays, meaning rabbinic holidays. What's interesting is you'll notice that the first halacha is not halachic. What is it? It's historical. When the Greeks took over during the Second Temple period, and they made all these decrees against the Jewish people, they made they nullified their religion. They didn't allow them to do Torah mitzvahs. And they would take their money and their children, their daughters, and they ruined the Beis HaMikdash. And they put so much pressure on the Jewish people until Hashem had mercy on us and saved us from their hands. V'hatzilam, v'gavru b'nei chashmonai ha-kohanim, the chashmonai ha-gdolim, v'hirgum, and they killed them. V'hoshil Yisrael miyadam v'hamidu melech min ha-kohanim, and they created a king from Kohanim, which is itself controversial. V'chazru malchus Yisrael yeser al masayim shana ad ha-chorban ha-sheni. And the sovereigns came back to the Jewish people for over 200 years. That is historically debatable, but that's how the Rambam says it. What's interesting is, it's called Halacha Aleph, but there's no Halacha there. There's nothing in there that I have to do. Right? There's in here something about history, the background of Hanukkah. So why does the Rambam put this in here? Because as I said before, the Rambam saw his Mishnah Torah as the end-all, be-all of all Jewish knowledge. And in order to be a Jewish person, you have to know the history of Hanukkah, which is why he tells the story.
What Hanukkah?
My Hanukkah, yeah? The Gemara and Shabbos.
He's talking about yeah. Hanukkah is here.
Well, he goes into more detail than the Gemara does, but you're right. Interestingly enough, by the way, the Gemara does not have a separate Masechta devoted to Hanukkah. It's in the middle of Masechta Shabbos, talking about lighting candles, right? And there is a separate Masechta for Megillah, for Purim. So, which might be another reason why the Rambam modeled his book after the Gemara, which is that he put Hanukkah's halachas after Megillah's in the same book. but not in its own book. Either way, interesting to note. Halacha beizuch shegavri Yisrael ayvim va'avdim b'chamish v'esrim b'chodesh kislev. It was the 25th of Kislev when they won. Haya v'nichnesu lahechav lo matzu shem and tahor. They couldn't find any pure olive. Mikdash el pach echav lo heya b'lahadlik el yomecha. There was only enough to light for one day. V'hidliku imenu neros hamaracha shmoni yamim. And they were able to light from that 8 days worth. Asher kashu zeisim meitziu shem and tahor, until they were able to make more olive oil.
Still no halachas.
Still no halachas. Halacha base. No halachas and halacha base. And then halacha gimel comes. Umi pnei zeh. And because of this, hiskinu chacham shavuos to ador. This is also not necessarily halachic for us, but at that time, they were metakin that they would make a holiday out of it. Sheyu shmonas hayamim ha'elu shetzchilasin milachamish shavuosim v'kislev. Yimei simcha v'halal. Interesting. The first thing he notes is these are days of simcha and halal. And then he says, "Umadlikin mehenaneros be'erav al pischei abatim." And then you put the candles. You light the candles. It doesn't say how many. All right, this is the Gemara goes through it anyway. Be'erav at nighttime on the openings of the houses. Bechol laila v'laila, every single night. Mishmonas haleilos laharos ligalos hanes, in order to show and to reveal the miracle. By the way, when I say these words, every single one of these words is a nuance that all the commentaries pick up on. Why does the Rambam say laharos and legalos? Are those not the same thing? To show and to reveal. So the commentaries will talk about why. What's the difference between those two? What are the aspects of the mitzvah the Rambam is trying to get at? This is not the Gemara's words. These are the Rambam's words when he says it. And he says them for meticulous reasons. V'yamim elu heinan nikran chanukah v'hein asurim behefse v'tanis kimei apurim. They're Aser and Hesper and Tanis, just like Purim. What's the Chiddush of just like Purim? Commentaries will talk about it. And similarly, the lighting of the candles is a mitzvah midivrei sofrim, which at least in this situation means rabbinic, not always the case for the Rambam, but it's just like Kriyas Megillah, just like reading the Megillah. There is a Megillah of Hanukkah which is not concretized. So, where...
He's not referring to that at all. Yeah.
No, I'm talking about the Maccabees.
The Book of Maccabees you're talking about.
That's a long book.
Is it? No. Is that long?
It seems long. I've had it...
Not longer than Koheles.
It's like, yeah. It was
really?
Longer, yeah.
Okay, I'd have to look back at it. I know that...
It was a three-year war. It was maybe it's the long version from Josephus, but that wasn't it.
Yeah, I don't know. I know that others who call our books the Old Testament include within the Old Testament a Book of Maccabees in theirs, but it's not part of ours. We have it, and you can read it, and you can learn it, but it's not part of our... Question becomes, are there halachic ramifications of learning it, that you have to say Berachas HaTorah? I don't know.
Why is he lumping Megillah in when he's talking about Hanukkah?
Yeah. Why? Well, he's making a halachic correlation to give us a sort of like a preset to understand what he's talking about. It's the same level as Purim stuff. But it's a good question.
And maybe the reason he's doing that is because since historically Purim was established by the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah.
Okay, yeah.
And so by lumping Hanukkah in with Purim,
it's putting the status.
Giving Hanukkah a higher status than you might think it would get.
Right, being that it's really
post.
Interesting. Okay. Yeah,
Badana. It could also be that one was the physical and one was the spiritual.
Yeah, that's definitely a difference between Hanukkah and Purim. The question I think Adina is dealing with is why is it that he feels the need to lump them together? Right, he's not making distinctions. He's actually bringing them together here. Kol shechayv b'kriyas Megillah chayv b'adlakas ner Chanukah. He continues the parallel and says, anyone who's chayv in Megillah is chayv in ner Chanukah. V'amalek goes up b'leila rishon mivarech shalosh brachos. You have three brachos, as we know, etc. Skipping to halacha hey b'chol yom v'yom mishmonas hayam ha'il gomer minas ha'halal u'mivarech lefanu baruch atah Hashem l'kinu me'al chalam ha'shekir shanu mitzosav ligmor sahala. This is a chiddush that the Rambam is taking from the Gemara, but also is of much controversy and much debate. Ben Yachid Ben Mitzibri is going to make a bracha on halal, even though it's a yantif, which is durabanan. It's a durabanan yantif that we say halal. We don't say halal by Purim. There are other reasons for that. But we say halal by Rosh Chodesh, which at least has a de'oraisa element to it. Right? It has a biblical element to it. Chodesh is el rachem Rosh Chodeshim. Chanukah is unique in that it brings it brings Hallel, a full Hallel, despite the fact that it's completely completely rabbinic. Now, there are other holidays where we say less than full Hallel, like Rosh Chodesh, we don't even say a full Hallel.
Later days was Pesach.
The later days of Pesach, we don't say full Hallel.
Why not Shabbos?
When he says L'gmor et HaHallel,
yeah.
I mean, that's obviously not the text of the bracha that we say today.
Right, yeah, so there's a difference.
I'm wondering, does he say that by the days that, the other days that we say?
Oh, is this a different bracha, you think?
No, yeah. Sometimes say the Gemara and sometimes the
Gemara. It depends, you mean for Sephardis or the Rambam? No, Sephardis in general. Yeah. So there are different brachas.
And they say the Gemara.
No, I was just wondering, do they say the Gemara on Rosh Chodesh, for example, when we don't
Well,
say
Sephardis never say bracha on Rosh Chodesh.
Oh, they don't say bracha.
Yeah, because that's a minhag. But in other times during the year, like a Pesach or Shavuos, they would say likro.
No, Shavuos is likro.
Shavuos is likmor?
Shavuos is a whole
Right. No, but I'm saying in the bracha, they say the word likmor?
Yeah. And on Pesach, the last day, they say likro.
Uh-huh. That I'm not from this.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Yeah. Sephardim, yeah. I'm not familiar. But the question is, what's the differentiation or how you have to do this? Alpha piece says the Rambam, Shekriyas HaHalal Mitzvah Midivrei Sofrim, Mevarech Alei HaShek Rishanu Mitzvosav. Even though saying Halal is Midivrei Sofrim, meaning rabbinic, we can still say the word Vetzivanu, that Hashem commanded us. Kederach Shemevarech Al HaMegillah of Yal HaEriv, which is an interesting tie-in. Shekol vaday shel divrei mevarchan alav. Anything that is an obvious or clear institution from the rabbis, we make a bracha on. Meaning v'tzivanu bracha. Aval davar shehu midivreiem v'ikar asiyasun lo mipnei hasafik. But if there's anything that's rabbinic, and the reason that it's rabbinic is because it's a safik, kigon maser demai ein mevarchan alav. Then we don't make a bracha on it.
He already said for Chanukah.
Yeah, he's explaining how that works. Because one could say, wait a second, it's rabbinic. How can you make a bracha? And what's the big...
Or not.
What?
For Hallel, we don't say the bracha on Purim.
Hallel.
Because it happened outside.
Yeah, that's what the Gemara says. The Gemara says either because it was we're still Ovdei Avadim, or because that the Megillah is the Hallel. Yeah. That's a separate discussion. What's the big question on this? Yeah, Viva? What food do we say Shekri Shana on? Well, I guess Kiddush and stuff, but that's Midoraisa. What's candles is a good question. Candles is a good question, but that's a Vaday. Although it's unclear where in the Gemara it says to say that bracha.
Pesach of Mitzrayim. Why do we say Halal for Pesach?
You were commanded to.
Yeah. That's a biblical commandment.
Oh, because it was, even though it wasn't in Israel.
Well, Halal is rabbinic. Oh, yeah. Well, that's... It's not really about in or outside of Eretz Yisrael. It's more about Geula versus Galus. Either way, so and then the big question, however, is Yom Tov Sheni. We say Asher Kedushan Mitzvosav Tzivanu all of Yom Tov Sheni. If we're sitting in a sukkah, if we're shaking a lulav, right, we say Asher Kedushan Mitzvosav Tzivanu. Well, lulav's not the best example, but...
Well, lulav's even
second night of the
question.
Seder.
Lulav's even more of a question.
Generally.
There was no mitzvah...
Right, that's rabbinic always. Yeah.
It's always rabbinic
after
the first day.
Yeah, so that's a big question, and the Gemara talks about it. It's not the Rambam. Says the Rambam, the reason we make it the same as the first day is so that people don't think it's a lesser day. You know, interesting question. By the way, this could be one of the questions you want to ask Rabbi Leibowitz on Motzei Shabbos. We're having a Q&A with him, a Bucky in Halacha. If you want to submit any questions, let me know. You can do it online. You can do it with me also. If you see here, the end here, it says, Hasagas HaRaibid. Who is the Raibid? Rav Avram ben David. Rav Avram ben David is perhaps known as the great rival of the Rambam. But if you look at the Mishnah Torah, he only comments on the Rambam maybe 5% of the time, which means that they agree 95% of the time.
Now,
we just like to point out
this
stuff.
This isn't the same David who's the Rambam's brother.
No. This is the Ravid. The Ravid is actually, I think, is older than the Rambam, I think. I think he outlives him, but he was older than him. I don't remember exactly. Also, Spain, really Provence, which gives him sort of like a dual nature. Interesting life also. V'lam avarach nal yontav sheni v'hem lo teknua el midni asavik kdei shelo yizhazlu bo. This aleph for the untrained student is not EFSHAR. It means Amar Avraham, which is the Ravid. So don't try to read in EFSHAR into all of his phrases because he says that every time. Amar Avram, Zeha Tama Abaya Val Rabba Cholak Alav V'Amar She'en HaTam L'Dmai El B'nei Sherov Amar Aretz Ma'astrin Aval Safek Achar Afil B'Dramam L'Varchin. So the Ravid points out, he doesn't say clearly what his stance is, but he points out that there's another opinion which says that you do make brachas on suffix. The Rambam clearly sided with Abaya in this situation. Whether or not this is one of the situations that we should pass like Abaya, I'm not sure. But either way, that's a little bit of the Rambam, that's the Mishneh Torah, that's his life, that's his, you know, unbelievable contributions to Jewish living nowadays. And we literally, our life depends on all the Rambam's words every single day. So to give a glimpse into the figure and the legend of the Rambam, hopefully that gives us a little more meaning into what we do every single day. Okay, everyone should have a good week.